A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's basically a confession of selective antiquing. He's always thought of himself as anti-antique, a tech guy through and through. But he recently fell in love with the ruling pen, this 400-year-old drafting tool that still outperforms anything modern for precision line work. So now he's wondering what else the past just did better, and more importantly, how do you separate the genuinely superior old tech from the stuff people collect just because it's old and pretty? It's a really interesting question about function versus nostalgia.
This is exactly the kind of question that makes people in the antique world uncomfortable because it draws a line right through their whole value system. You've got people who collect Victorian hair jewelry, no functional value whatsoever, pure sentiment and aesthetics. And then you've got people who use a 100-year-old Stanley No. 4 plane every day because nothing at the hardware store comes close. Same label, antique enthusiast, completely different operating systems.
Victorian hair jewelry.
Oh, it's a whole thing. Human hair woven into bracelets, brooches, watch chains, mourning jewelry mostly. Very big in the 1800s.
That's the arts and crafts equivalent of keeping your toenail clippings in a jar.
Yet people pay thousands for it. But that's exactly the split the prompt is getting at. There's the antique world of sentiment and aesthetics and patina, which is fine, no judgment on people who love that, and then there's the world of antiques that are just better engineered than their modern replacements. The ruling pen is a perfect entry point to this.
Let's talk about the ruling pen for a minute, because I think most people have never even seen one. What is it, and why is it better?
A ruling pen is essentially two metal blades that come together at a point held by a thumbscrew. You load ink or paint between the blades, and it flows out in an incredibly precise line. They were the standard drafting tool from roughly the 1600s until technical pens took over in the mid-20th century. Architects, engineers, cartographers, anyone who needed consistent line width used a ruling pen. And here's what's wild. The ruling pen can still do things that modern paint markers and technical pens cannot. Line width control down to fractions of a millimeter, for one. You adjust the thumbscrew and suddenly you're laying down a line that's 0.05 millimeters or a full millimeter and is perfectly consistent. Modern paint markers flood. They blob at the start of a line. They're unpredictable on different surfaces. A ruling pen, once you learn to use it, gives you exactly what you dial in. It also works with basically any liquid medium. India ink, acrylic paint, gold size, enamel. Try putting gold size through a modern technical pen and you'll destroy it.
It's not just that it's charmingly old. It's actually more versatile.
A ruling pen has no moving parts except the thumbscrew. It never clogs permanently because you can open the blades completely and clean every surface. Compare that to a modern paint marker where the valve mechanism fails and the whole thing is trash. Or a technical pen where dried ink means you're soaking it in solvent for 3 days and praying.
There's something almost perverse about a 400-year-old design that refuses to be improved upon, like the wheel or the spoon.
Or the safety pin. Walter Hunt invented the safety pin in 1849, and the design has not changed in any meaningful way since. The spring coil, the clasp, it's perfect. Every attempt to improve, it has made it worse.
That's the category we're looking for. Things where the original design hit a ceiling, not because nobody tried to improve it, but because the physics of the problem were already solved. But here's my question. How do you tell the difference between a ruling pen and a vinyl record?
Right, because the prompt brings up vinyl as the counterexample. And I think this is where the debate gets really interesting, because vinyl enthusiasts will fight you in the street over this.
They're very committed.
And I want to be careful here because I know people who love vinyl, and I'm not here to ruin anyone's Saturday morning ritual. But from a fidelity standpoint, the prompt is completely correct. Vinyl is inferior to digital audio on basically every measurable dimension. Frequency response, dynamic range, channel separation, noise floor, wow and flutter, distortion. Digital wins across the board. A compact disc from 1982 outperforms the best vinyl pressing ever made on every technical metric.
Why do people insist it sounds better?
A few things are happening. One is that vinyl introduces harmonic distortion that some people find pleasing. It's technically degradation, but it's degradation that happens to sound warm to human ears. The second is that a lot of modern digital masters are aggressively compressed and sound terrible, not because digital is bad, but because mastering engineers are making bad choices. And the third is ritual. The act of putting on a record, the large artwork, the deliberate listening, it changes how people pay attention, and they attribute the improved experience to the medium rather than to the attention they're giving it.
Vinyl isn't better. It's just that the listening experience is different, and people conflate the two.
And that's the line. A ruling pen is objectively better at certain tasks. Vinyl is subjectively preferred by some people. Those are different categories.
Which brings us to the core question. What other things fall into the ruling pen category? What else did previous generations just do better?
Let me start with something that'll resonate with anyone who's ever tried to write on a greasy surface. The grease pencil, also called a China marker. It's basically a wax-based pencil wrapped in paper that you peel back as you use it. Invented in the early 20th century, and it's still the best tool for writing on glass, metal, plastic, wet surfaces, oily surfaces. Modern dry erase markers won't stick to oil. But a grease pencil just works, and it's completely immune to temperature, moisture, and surface contamination.
I've seen those in hardware stores and never thought about them. They look like a crayon had a baby with a pencil.
They're basically unchanged for a century. The paper wrap is the whole mechanism. There's nothing to break. Another one, the machinist's surface gauge. It's a precision scribing tool used in metalworking, and the basic design from the early 1900s is still what professionals reach for. A cast iron base, an adjustable arm, and a hardened steel scribe point. No batteries, no calibration drift, no software updates. It just marks a line at a precise height relative to a surface plate, and it'll do that for 50 years without complaint.
I'm noticing a pattern here. No batteries, no software, no planned obsolescence.
That's a huge part of it, and it connects to something the prompt is really circling around, which is that pragmatic antique enthusiasm is fundamentally about rejecting the parts of modern manufacturing that are worse. Not all of it. Nobody's rejecting modern metallurgy or precision machining. But the stuff that's designed to fail, the stuff that's optimized for cost at the expense of function, that's what the ruling pin crowd is walking away from.
It's almost like there's a sweet spot in manufacturing history. Too early, and the metallurgy wasn't there. The tolerances were sloppy. Too late, and you're in the era of injection-molded plastic and planned obsolescence. But there's this golden period. Roughly, what, 1880 to 1960?
That's a really good window. You've got the Industrial Revolution's machining capabilities fully matured, quality steel is widely available, but you haven't yet hit the point where cost accounting started stripping the quality out of everything. A hand plane made by Stanley in 1920 is going to have a thicker casting, better steel in the blade, and more care in the machining than most planes made today under $150. And you can buy that 100-year-old plane for $30 at a flea market, spend an hour tuning it up, and it'll outperform a modern $200 plane.
That's the part that blows my mind. It's not just better. It's often cheaper.
Because the market prices antiques based on collectability, not functionality. A Stanley Bedrock No. 605, which is one of the best smoothing planes ever made, might cost you $150 in good condition. A modern Lyon Nielsen equivalent, which is a direct copy of the Bedrock design, by the way, costs $400. The antique is the budget option.
The antique premium is actually inverted in some categories.
For user tools, absolutely. The premium is on pristine collector pieces with original boxes and decals. A plane with 80% of its original Japanning and some honest wear? That's a user, and users are cheap. The collectors are chasing condition, not function, which means the functional antiques are undervalued relative to what they can do.
That's a fascinating market inefficiency. The collectors are pricing in rarity and aesthetics, and the users get to benefit from all the engineering without paying the premium.
This is where the prompt's question about identifying these things gets really practical, because there are tells. If you walk into an antique store and see something that looks like it was made to be used hard for 100 years, and there's no obvious modern equivalent that's built the same way, you might be looking at a ruling pen situation.
Give me some more examples. What else is out there?
Let's talk about cast iron cookware. A Griswold skillet from the 1930s has a machined cooking surface that's almost glass smooth. Modern cast iron, even from good brands like Lodge, comes with a pebbly surface from the sand casting that they don't machine down anymore. You can season it and build up layers to smooth it out, but it takes years. A vintage Griswold is smooth the day you strip and reseason it, and the casting itself is thinner and lighter. They used better iron and more precise molds.
It's lighter, smoother, and better at the one thing a skillet is supposed to do.
It costs about the same as a new Lodge if you're patient on eBay.
What about things that aren't tools? The prompt mentions being into technology. Are there antiques that a tech person would appreciate?
A good slide rule, say, a K&E Decilon from the 1960s, is an analog computer that requires no power, works in a vacuum, and can do multiplication, division, trigonometry, logarithms, and roots to three significant figures faster than you can pull out your phone. Engineers used them to design the Saturn V rocket. Every major bridge and skyscraper built before the 1970s was calculated on slide rules.
They're beautiful objects. All those scales, the cursor, the precision etching.
They teach number sense in a way that calculators don't. With a calculator, you punch in numbers and trust the output. With a slide rule, you have to track the order of magnitude in your head. The slide rule gives you the digits, and your brain supplies the decimal point. It forces you to actually think about what the answer should be.
That's the thing about a lot of these older tools. They don't just do the job. They make you better at understanding the job.
There's a concept in tool design called transparency. A transparent tool reveals the mechanism. A handsaw is transparent. You can see the teeth, you can feel the cut, you understand what's happening. A circular saw is opaque. The blade spins, the guard covers it, the motor makes noise, and you just kind of trust that it's cutting. Neither is morally superior, but transparent tools teach you the physics of the operation. Opaque tools hide it.
If you're the kind of person who wants to understand the thing you're doing, older tools are often more satisfying, even beyond the functional advantage.
That connects to the second part of the prompt. How do you identify as a pragmatic antique enthusiast in opposition to the mainstream antiquers? Because the mainstream antique world is often about rarity, provenance, and aesthetics. The pragmatic user is about function. Those value systems barely overlap.
It's almost a completely different hobby that happens to involve the same objects.
A collector might buy a 19th century molding plane because it has a maker stamp from a rare Ohio plane maker and it's in mint condition. A user buys a molding plane because they need to reproduce a historic profile in a house they're restoring and the modern router bits don't match. The collector puts it on a shelf. The user puts it to wood.
The user probably paid a tenth of what the collector paid.
For the exact same plane, minus the bragging rights. The collector plane might have 95% of its original finish and a crisp stamp. The user plane has some rust and a chip in the wedge, but the iron is still good and the profile is still accurate, functionally identical for the actual work.
How do you find the user grade stuff? Where do you even look?
Flea markets, estate sales, and the four parts or repair listings on eBay. Also, and this is a pro tip, look for the tools that are covered in grime. Collectors want clean. Users want cheap. A plane that's caked in sawdust and surface rust is going to sell for nothing. And half an hour with some evaporust and a Scotch-Brite pad will reveal a perfectly functional tool underneath.
The grime discount.
The grime discount is real. I've bought hand planes for $15 that needed nothing but cleaning and sharpening, and they outperform anything under $200 new.
What about things that aren't tools at all? Are there categories where the old version is just better designed as an object?
Mechanical watches are an interesting case. A quartz watch is more accurate, cheaper, and more durable than any mechanical watch ever made. A $10 Casio keeps better time than a Patek Philippe. But mechanical watches are marvels of microengineering. Hundreds of tiny parts, no battery, powered by the motion of your wrist. They're worse at the primary function, but better as objects of human ingenuity.
A mechanical watch is more like vinyl, not like a ruling pen.
It's the aesthetic and engineering appreciation, not functional superiority. The ruling pen category requires that the old thing actually does the job better. Not equally well, not differently, better.
Let me throw out a category and see if it fits. Double-edged safety razors.
That's a great one. A vintage Gillette Fatboy from the 1950s is a better razor than most modern cartridge razors. The blades are sharper because they're not coated in that lubricating strip that gums up. The single blade cuts cleanly instead of the lift and cut multi-blade system that tugs the hair and causes ingrown hairs. The weight of the razor does the work so you don't press down. And the blades cost 10 cents each instead of $4 per cartridge.
Again, it's cheaper.
A 100-pack of feathered double-edged blades is about $30 and will last most people 2 years. A year of Gillette Fusion cartridges costs something like $150. The antique razor plus a lifetime supply of blades costs less than a single year of cartridges.
That's the kind of math that would make a tech person's brain light up. It's not nostalgia, it's optimization.
Optimization is exactly the right frame. The prompt is from someone who works in tech and automation. This isn't about romanticizing the past. It's about identifying where the past accidentally got something right and the present accidentally made it worse, often for reasons that have nothing to do with function.
The cartridge razor is a perfect example of that. It's not worse because engineers forgot how to make razors. It's worse because the business model demanded recurring revenue and patent-protected consumables.
The razor and blades model, literally. And once you start seeing that pattern, you see it everywhere. Inkjet printers with chip cartridges, coffee pod machines, smart home devices that brick themselves when the company shuts down its servers. A lot of modern products are optimized for extraction, not function.
One heuristic for finding ruling pen style antiques is look for categories where the modern version is subscription based or consumable, locked, and the old version was designed to be owned and maintained.
That's a fantastic heuristic. And it applies to a lot of kitchen equipment, too. A vintage stand mixer from the 1950s, a Sunbeam Mixmaster, or an early KitchenAid has metal gears and a motor that can be rebuilt. A modern KitchenAid, unless you buy the top-tier model, has plastic gears that strip under a heavy load. The vintage one is repairable. The modern one is replaceable.
The vintage one is often cheaper on the used market.
Because it's not new, and it doesn't have a warranty. But the warranty on a modern appliance is a year, and the vintage one has already lasted 70.
What about audio equipment? Since the prompt mentions working with audio professionally, are there any old audio tools that are better?
Microphones are the strongest case. A Neumann U87 from the 1960s is still one of the best vocal microphones ever made, and the modern U87 AI is essentially the same design with minor tweaks. But the vintage ones command a premium because the capsules age in ways that some engineers prefer. That's more vinyl adjacent. It's subjective. The stronger case is something like the Shure SM57, which has been in continuous production since 1965 with essentially no changes. It's not vintage versus modern. It's the same thing, still being made because it's perfect for what it does.
The SM57 is a ruling pen that never went away.
And there are a lot of those, products where the design converged on the optimum decades ago and all the innovation since has been marketing, not engineering.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the golden window of manufacturing, roughly 1880 to 1960. Is there a way to identify products from that era that are worth looking for, even if you don't know the specific category?
Material tells are a big one. If you pick something up and it's heavier than you expected, that's often a good sign. Not always. Sometimes it's just cast iron that should have been aluminum. But generally, mass was not the enemy in that era the way it is now. Manufacturers weren't trying to shave grams to save on shipping costs. A vintage tool feels substantial.
The heft test.
The heft test is surprisingly reliable. Another tell, can you see how it works? If you can look at a mechanism and understand the principle in 30 seconds, it's probably well designed. Overcomplication is almost always a modern sin. A third tell are the fastener standard. If it uses flathead screws, it's probably from before the Phillips head took over in the 1930s. If it uses hex bolts in standard sizes, it's repairable. If it uses proprietary security screws, it was designed to keep you out.
Standard fasteners, visible mechanism, surprising heft. That's a good checklist.
One more, can you find a manual for it? Not a modern PDF, but an original manual that assumes the owner will do their own maintenance. Old manuals are incredible. They include parts diagrams, lubrication instructions, troubleshooting guides. They assumed the user was competent. Modern manuals are mostly safety warnings and a phone number for authorized service centers.
The manual is a proxy for repairability. I like that.
It tells you everything about the design philosophy. A company that expects you to fix it builds it differently than a company that expects you to throw it away.
Let's talk about the social dimension of this, because the prompt asks about being in opposition to mainstream antiquers. I imagine there's some tension.
There can be. The mainstream antique world often values rarity above all else. A rare piece in poor condition is worth more than a common piece in perfect condition. The user community inverts that. A common piece in good working condition is ideal, because parts are available and the design is proven. The user wants the Toyota Corolla of antiques. The collector wants the one-of-one prototype that never went into production.
Which means they're often not competing for the same items.
Most of the time. The friction comes when users modify or ruin something that a collector would have preserved, sharpening a chisel that had its original factory grind, stripping and refinishing a piece that had original finish, using a tool that's too nice to use.
The too nice to use thing drives me crazy. It's a tool. It was made to be used. Not using it is the actual disrespect.
There's a whole philosophy around this. Some people call it user collectorship, or working antiques. The idea is that the highest respect you can pay a well-made tool is to use it for its intended purpose. Letting it sit on a shelf is turning it into a sculpture. Using it keeps it alive.
It's the difference between owning a horse and owning a painting of a horse.
And the horse wants to run.
If someone listening wants to start finding their own ruling pens, their own personal category of old things that are better, where do they start?
I think you start with a problem. Don't go browsing antique stores looking for things to want. That's how you end up with a house full of decorative junk. Instead, notice when a modern tool frustrates you, when the paint marker blobs, when the kitchen knife won't hold an edge, when the new lamp feels flimsy and tips over. Then ask, was there an era when this was made better, and go looking for that specific thing.
Problem. First antiquing.
Problem. First antiquing. It keeps you honest. You're not collecting, you're solving. Every antique you buy is replacing something modern that failed you.
The cost savings are real because you're not buying things you don't need.
Though I should say, it can become its own kind of obsession. Once you realize how much better a vintage cast iron skillet is, you start wondering what else you've been putting up with. You go down the rabbit hole of vintage kitchen tools, vintage woodworking tools, vintage drafting equipment. It can get expensive in aggregate even if each individual piece is a bargain.
There's a discipline to it. Which brings me to the final part of the prompt. How do you identify as a pragmatic antique enthusiast? What's the identity?
I think the identity is user. Simple as that. You're not a collector, you're not a preservationist, you're not a historian. You're someone who uses old things because they work better. The label almost doesn't matter. It's the orientation that matters. You judge objects by function, not by age or rarity or aesthetics. Age is a clue that something might be well made, not a virtue in itself.
You could walk into an antique store and walk right past the Victorian era jewelry without a second glance.
Without breaking stride. But you'd stop dead in front of a 19th century machinist's chest full of precision tools.
You'd probably pay less than the person buying the hair jewelry. There's something satisfying about that. The market undervalues function and overvalues decoration. The pragmatic enthusiast gets to exploit that inefficiency.
It's the value investor's approach to material culture. Buy what's undervalued by the market's metrics, hold it forever, use it daily.
The ruling pen is the perfect mascot for this. 400 years old, still unmatched, costs maybe $20.
It will outlast you. That's the other thing about this category of objects. They were built before obsolescence was a design strategy. A well-made ruling pen from 1850 will still be a well-made ruling pen in 2050. The modern paint marker you didn't buy instead of, it will be in a landfill.
There's an environmental argument here too, which we haven't even touched. Buying one antique tool that lasts a lifetime versus buying and discarding a series of modern tools that break.
It's the ultimate in reduce and reuse. The manufacturing energy was spent a century ago. You're just keeping the thing in circulation. And when you're done with it, someone else will use it. These objects have already outlived their original owners. They'll probably outlive us too.
That's actually kind of moving, in a weird way. Being a temporary steward of something that'll keep working long after you're gone.
It changes how you think about ownership. You don't really own a 100-year-old tool. You're borrowing it from the next user.
Alright, so to pull this together, the ruling pen is not an anomaly. There's a whole category of objects where the old version is, measurably better than the modern replacement. The tells are simple mechanisms, repairable design, standard fasteners, surprising heft, and a complete absence of planned obsolescence. The sweet spot is roughly 1880 to 1960. The strategy is problem first. Let your frustrations with modern tools guide you to the old ones that solve the problem better. And the identity is user, not collector.
That's a really clean summary. The only thing I'd add is that part of the joy here is the learning curve. A ruling pen takes practice. A double-edged safety razor takes practice. A hand plane takes practice. These aren't push-button tools. They reward skill development, and that's part of why people who get into this tend to go deep. It's not just that the tool is better, it's that using it makes you better.
Which is the opposite of most modern product design, where the goal is to make the tool so easy to use that you never have to think about it.
There's a place for that. I don't need to understand the thermodynamics of my refrigerator. But for the things you care about, the things you do with your hands, the things that are part of your craft, transparency and skill development are features, not bugs.
The pragmatic antique enthusiast is really just someone who refuses to outsource their competence to a product manager.
That's the most tech industry way you could possibly put it, and I completely agree. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the hot springs of the Aleutian Islands, a bacterium called Thermus eluticus produces a heat-stable enzyme that chemically cross-links its own DNA using a unique sulfur bridge between cytosine molecules, a molecular adaptation that prevents the double helix from unraveling at temperatures above 80 degrees Celsius.
I don't know what to do with that.
I'm just impressed the bacterium figured it out before we did. This has been My Weird Props, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. Find more at myweirdprompts.com.
I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
Go find something old that works better than something new.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird props, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.